Hello, my name is Craig Schreiner, and I'm an alcoholic. Really an honor and a privilege to be here. Everybody's behaved, sober. This gentleman stopped eating potato chips while the guy read the 12 steps. Looks like the smokers definitely outweigh the non-smokers. It's always a privilege to be at a gathering of Alcoholics Anonymous, and really an honor to be in front of you. I hope today that I can share with you my experience, strength, and hope, and what it's taken for me to kind of come to grips with this life of sobriety, and to try to communicate to you as best I can what the joy of living means to me today. Because I can honestly say that based on the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the people that were here and always seem to be here, regardless of my mental or emotional or spiritual frame of mind, to help me deal with the problems that are unfolding on a daily basis. And for that, I'm really grateful for this wonderful fellowship. And this fellowship's all over the world. And today in my travels and the things that I do for a living, I travel around the world. And I've been in meetings in Hong Kong and China and London and where are we? Kentucky and, you know, all these... all these exotic places around the world, you know. We had a wonderful round of golf this morning. You know, this individual is extraordinarily sick. When he would come here at 6:15 this morning and pick me up and a few other people, and went and played golf at 7 this morning. It was an absolutely beautiful morning. And I really feel as if I've been on sort of a vacation, and it's been nice to be here. I identified very much last night with the first speaker. I wasn't around for the second speaker. I was tired and got to bed a little bit earlier. But I could identify very much with the language of the heart and the message that she sent. Her pain in terms of the qualification of this, although I never was up for any federal indictments of any sort, I probably should have been, but they never caught up with me. But needless to say, I still had a lot in common with Mickey last night, and that was really a great opportunity to be there. I know that when I first got here, that Jeff was a little self-conscious about speaking, because I was one time over here and then up here and then down here, and it seemed like, well, you know, they sort of moved me around enough. Part of my life, you know, it's the way I've always been. But it's nice to be here. I've been treated very nicely. I got to my room. There was a basket of fruit and candy, and I didn't ask anybody, but this thing was in there from Alateens, I think, or Al-Anon, and it had a pin in it, and I was supposed to put it on, right? I didn't ask, you know. So I did all right, okay? You know, I'll never ask for help, you know, but I just sort of assumed that I was supposed to wear this thing. So I put it on, and I got that right. And I appreciate Carlos. Carlos will have a year in about a week, right? Is that right? Isn't that tremendous? Right. I mean, it shows respect for someone who's in their first year would actually put a suit and tie on and come up to introduce or to read speakers. And that's really what I'm talking about, and that is with respect. And it's wonderful to be, you know, part of a whole human being today. I have the disease of alcoholism. And as my sponsor explained to me, it's a disease that's fourfold. It's physical. And when I take a drink of alcohol, I cannot tell you what's going to happen. I cannot tell you when I'm going to stop drinking. I have an allergic reaction to it. I physically just lose control. And I can't tell you whether it'll be one drink or five drinks, etc., and so on. I stopped. My last drink was March 6, 1978. Prior to that, the first time, or when I started drinking, my last drink was about a year and a half. So the last time that I took a drink, it took me a year and a half to stop drinking. And that to me is a good indication and a good reminder, you know, every day for at least a year and a half, that, you know, if I take one drink, I will have an allergic reaction to it. My body just goes bonkers. It's like people that have allergies. I noticed a man in the foursome in front of us, they kept coughing and sneezing. It's because the pollen is out, his body's having an allergic reaction. Well, I didn't, you know, leave the golf course because this guy couldn't control his sneezing, you know. He has an allergy. And when I look at my alcoholism early on, as it was described to me as an allergy, you know, it made it a little bit easier to accept the fact that I couldn't control my drinking. Made it a little bit easier, knowing that it's an allergic reaction. It's a mental disease. If I am left alone to my own devices, I will be dishonest. Because I am primarily motivated by self-centered fears. End of sentence. End of paragraph. And because I'm motivated by self-centered fears, I will rationalize and justify and delude myself and live in denial and delusion and all the other things. I will actually fundamentally believe things that are wrong. Like, I have a physical allergy to alcohol. Yeah, but, and I will drink for another year and a half or whatever it takes to stop drinking alcohol, because I lived under the delusion that I could control my drinking. So left alone, I will pretty much be dishonest, guaranteed. It's an emotional disease. My first drunk was 13 years of age, almost exactly the same as the speaker last night. Stole the beer out of a garage, long neck bottle, etc. It was warm, same thing. That first drunk, there was no need anymore to grow up. I was 13 years old, and at that point in time, alcohol did all those things that I was supposed to learn when I was growing up, dealing with anger or envy or jealousy or resentment or etc. And there's no need to grow up anymore. So emotionally, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 26, I was 13 years old emotionally. It's an emotional disease. I got to grow up. That's what sobriety has been, is lessons in growing up. Last but not least, it's a spiritual disease, in that I really had successfully shut myself off to the sunlight of the Spirit. I completely, utterly excluded God of any sort out of my life. There was no need for a power greater than myself, because I, moi, was the power greater than myself, so to speak. And therefore, I really sort of had wrapped myself up in myself, and making myself really the smallest package you could conceive of. And that's pretty much it. Fourfold disease. And when I had an opportunity to start to work with my sponsor, he gave me 9 paragraphs that he wanted me to read. And the first ones he showed me were on page 27. That's Dr. Young, who's talking to Roland. And Roland is thinking that the gates of hell have crashed in on him. And one of the world's leading psychoanalysts is telling this alcoholic that he doesn't think that there's anything he can do to help him. Chronic alcoholics of his case, he had seen, you know, literally gone into despair and drink themselves to death via insanity. And Roland must have felt absolutely as if the gates of hell had come in on him, because here's, you know, Sigmund Freud's colleague, you know, one of the greatest psychiatric minds in the world, saying, there's no hope for you. He said, but, resentment breath, you know, there is a, you know, there is something called a spiritual experience. Now, that's the only thing that I have seen help chronic alcoholics of your case recover, is a spiritual experience. He says, and that's what I've been trying to evoke in you, is this phenomena of a spiritual experience. And, you know, at that point, there's a little asterisk. And down at the bottom of the page, it says, see spiritual experience appendix. You know, so my sponsor, the next thing he wanted me to read was the spiritual experience. So we go to the back of the book, and sure enough, there's a little chapter in there, and it talks about the spiritual experience. It talks in there very specifically about the indispensables to the recovery, to bring about the spiritual experience, and their honesty, open-mindedness, and the willingness to change or to take action. Those three ingredients. And with those things, you can actually help to bring a spiritual experience to pass. And then there's this little 2-3 sentences on the bottom of that. And it's a quote by some, I guess, contemporary philosopher at the time. And it said, you know, I'll paraphrase this as best I can. You know, there's one thing that will keep Craig Schreiner in everlasting ignorance for as long as he's alive, and that is contempt prior to investigation. Well, yeah, but. And that yeah, but, that frame of mind is how I started just about every response that I made to every individual I ever met after, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, whether they were even complimenting me. Gee, Craig, you look nice. Well, yeah, but, or, you know, I went to that meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous, but those people are a little old, or, yeah, but they, you know, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but. Well, what that is a closed mind. When I hear myself say those words today, that means my mind is shut to an idea or to something that someone is trying to transmit to me. I won't just let it sort of come in and stick there. I just yeah but it and close it out. Well, today I understand that that's what will keep me in everlasting ignorance. Now, from the back of the book, then, he wanted me to look at one more area specifically, and that was page 45. And it talks about what the dilemma with the disease of alcoholism is. And Mickey put it so succinctly last night that alcohol is really one of the symptoms of the disease of alcoholism, but it's the lack of power that's the dilemma. And that's what it says right on that page in 45. It's the lack of power that's the dilemma. And that the reason what this book was written, this big blue book, was to help me get in touch with a power that's greater than myself. To help me with my problem of powerlessness. It's alcohol was the vehicle by which God got my attention. And it was that which really brought me to my knees. Many other things didn't. The police, the parents, the girlfriends, etc. Those tried to, but alcohol was really what imprisoned me and brought me to my knees. Now that is, in essence, sort of, what the disease is and what does it take to arrest it, and then the tools that it takes to bring about the spiritual experience. Now, if anybody wants to get up and go, that's sort of the intellectual part of the sharing today. That's basically what I've encapsulated out of the big book. You're all excused from this point, but what I'd like to talk about now, what I'd like to spend a little bit of time sharing is that little bit of head knowledge that I have, that direction that my sponsor gave me. Having it up here is one thing, but going from here to here at 12 or 18 inches is what I want to talk about now, because just equipped with that knowledge has not really brought about what I would call quality sobriety. It's been a rough journey in the 18-some years that I've been in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think what best describes me, the person, is the situation that happened. I grew up in Akron, Ohio. I was born in Kansas City, but my parents moved up there to Akron when I was about 5. Actually, they moved back to Akron. And it snowed real heavily, so heavily that we had our school closed. And my other two brothers were content to stay inside and just play, the little electric football games and all those, whatever you do when there's a day off. I, for some reason, wanted to go out and shovel snow because I heard that you could do that and make money and do things. And I was 5 or 6, maybe 6. And I was pretty small. I was always very small till college, till I grew. I had this shovel, and it was taller than me, and I was all dressed up. And my mom said, "Well, where are you going?" I said, "Well, I'm going to go out and shovel walks." She just sort of patronized me and said, "Well, okay, start with ours." And so I did. By the time I got done, the lady next door had waved me over, and I went over, and she said, "Would you mind?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I'd love to." And I told her how much we'd charge. And so I got the thing done. I couldn't believe it. And she gave me some money. She said, "The lady across the street wants to know if you'd like to come over and do hers." So I did that, and then I just, this whole referral thing just kind of kept going all the way down the line. I was outside, I think, for the better part of 7 or 8 hours. And I had accumulated through my efforts $6 or $7. And let's see, that was when I was 6. Today, I'm 44 years old today. This is my birthday, August 3rd. So that was, my mom wanted me to make sure I said that to everybody, So that was 36 years ago. Do you know how far $6 went 36 years ago? That was the most amount of money that I had ever seen. That was the most amount of money I ever had in my life. And I mean, a nickel was a big deal. You could buy a lot of things for a nickel at that point. I had $6 or $7. Now, I had this thought. I remember it said, "Take it home and put it in the piggy bank." And that thought disappeared instantly. And I had this other thought that said, "Hey, $6. Let's go down to Blackie's." Now, Blackie's was what I considered my most wonderful place to be as a child. I'll never forget it because it had these beautiful glass doors, and you opened them up, and inside was this marble bar, and there were these stools that had stainless steel stems, and they spun around so you could be up to the height of the bar. There was a big, beautiful mirror behind it. There were all these shiny glasses and everything, and it was a soda fountain, but it was my equivalent of a bar, and I loved it. I just thought this was the greatest place to be. So I blew into Blackie's, and I was saying, "Cokes for everybody," Hey, I was just like spending this money, And it was burning a hole in my pocket. And next thing I know, I've blown like all $6. And I bought people I didn't even know ice cream sundaes. And I ended up buying a model that was sitting up on the top shelf. It was of a car that had a big motor sticking through it and the big wheels, and all that, because I so much admired Ernie. Ernie was the next door neighbor. Ernie was 16 years old. He had muscles like you. You know what I mean? This guy was huge. He was great looking. I was this little pipsqueak. Ernie drove a car and he had girlfriends and he had all these models. I got to go in his room one time. He had models of aircraft and planes and I just thought he was the greatest thing in the whole world. Well, I bought a model that was like the equivalent of what Ernie would have in his room. Except when you're 6, you don't build models like that. That's like takes, 10 years of experience. It's 300 parts. But all I saw was that car, the big girl with the little bathing suit, and I was going to make this model. That's what I wanted to do. So So I took this thing upstairs. I mean, it's really, you know, something that someone 16 years old to do, not someone 6. And I'll never forget, I was upstairs and I was, you know, I pulled this boxcar and I put the thing up there and I so I could see it. And then I had took all these parts out, you know, and I started to put this thing together. And I was experimenting with this, that, and the other thing. And after about 2 hours, I'd made a complete mess of this thing. I had destroyed it. I had things glued together that shouldn't have been glued together. I had a thing done and there was like 50 parts left, you know. What did I forget, you know? And I struggled with this thing as much as I could because I wanted to take it down and show my dad and my brothers and be the envy of the class at show and tell, ooh, ah, look at Craig, isn't he so fantastic? And I was having all these kind of fantasies about how great I was going to be. Well, needless to say, I made a mess out of it. Needless to say that I was going downstairs in frustration to sort of cry to my dad. And I got up to walk away and there's something stuck on my shoes. And it was the instructions to the model. Now, what's the point? What is the point I'm trying to make here? 6 years old. I do not have the ability or even the mindset to ask for help. Never even occurred to me that this model is so difficult that you would go even to my older brother and say, Rob, could you help me to build this model? It doesn't even enter my mind. It's just do it. Just do it, you know, and let just do it. And I destroyed it. Now, as I went downstairs, I felt bad about myself. I felt like I wasted all this time. I wasted all this money. It was like $2.50. It was about a third of the money that I had, and it was gone. I mean, it did not look like it was supposed to. And I was going to show and tell a class, and now I was ashamed of what I'd done. But the object lesson of, you know, asking for help went right over my head. Now, take that same little six-year-old with enough energy that'll go out and shovel rocks for 7 or 8 hours. Take that money, go do something like that, have all those great intentions, all that energy, and then it's got that little sort of spark in him, and throw something in me like alcohol that's flammable. My first drunk was just almost exactly as Mickey described last night. Stole the beer out of the garage, 13 years old, sleeping out, after about the third or fourth strohs, warm beer, all of a sudden I remember inside feeling as warm as the fire that was at our campsite. And I all of a sudden was, oh my God, this is absolutely unbelievable. I feel great. And everything is in slow motion. And unfortunately, that euphoric state only lasted about, I don't know, because that's all I remember. Now, it's like the next morning, okay? I'm hearing people, I know there's people at the campsite, but I don't know where I am. It's dark, it's musty, I'm trying to recognize these odors. One's like, is that urine? Is that feces? Is that, you know, what is that? And where am I, and why can't I see anything? And I'm struggling. Well, I was head first in my sleeping bag with my feet sticking out. And I was like this butterfly trying to get out of a cocoon, you know what I mean? And I had no idea where I was. It took me a couple of minutes to just realize that I was in the bag upside down, and I had urinated, I had wet the bag, I mean, it's just junk, oh yeah. So then I get out, and I finally sort of come to, and then all of a sudden I realize, I think I'm going to throw up out of my ears, my nose, my mouth, there's stuff coming out of my rear end, there's no pants on me, they're up in a tree on fire, you know, and all my friends are laughing at me. And they were saying, you know what, you were so funny last night. And that's all I heard. The fact that I was as sick as I'd ever been in my whole life, that I had no idea what had happened to me in the last couple of hours, and that I was almost half naked in front of my friends, and there was just secretions all over me. I immediately thought, wow, that was cool, whatever it was, and I can't wait to do it again. I mean, the hangover, none of that stuff meant anything. What it meant was that feeling. 13 years old, first drunk, and that's all it took. I don't care from that point on. I can tell you about 13 more years of drinking till I was 26. But I tell you what, that's why I drank, was for that euphoric state that I didn't need to grow up. I didn't need to worry about whether they accepted me or not. At that point, I was 6'6", handsome, strong, could talk to anybody, wasn't afraid of this, wasn't afraid of that. Boom, alcohol just eliminated me or did not allow me, or I didn't have any need to grow up. Period. And it was my power of choice. And 13 more years of that, just keep throwing the flames, and it got to the point where drinking every day. I had my first job as a shoeshine boy at a country club. I started to caddy when I was 12 or 13, I think it was about the same time, about 13, 14 years old. Except when I would go downhill, the bags would drag on the ground, and I'd scuff the bottom of them, and they didn't like that bags were very expensive. So they said, you have to grow more before we'll let you caddy, but you're here every morning, go down to the locker room and shine shoes, and be a locker room attendant. So I did that for a while. Well, I was 14 years of age, or no, 15 years of age, and I got fired from my first job because I was drunk. I bought a fifth of whiskey for Jesse, who taught me how to shine shoes. This wonderful man, who was a wonderful human being. And the boss was gone that day, and he was having having a couple drinks, which he was allowed to do on Sunday afternoon. And I poured, he poured me whatever this stuff was in a Coke, and I had a couple drinks. And the manager came back and saw me sitting downstairs, sort of slashed. And so I got fired from my first job. I was 15 years old for drinking. And I'll never forget riding my bicycle home drunk, you know, and they called my mom, told her that I was going to, you know, that I'd gotten fired. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is the end of the world. I mean, I can't believe that I actually got fired for drinking, and I don't even have a... So I got home. My mother was having a party for some reason. It was like a picnic or something on Sunday with her friends, and she was kind of half in the bag. And she saw me, and she said, you know, you don't look drunk, but the bicycle ride had sort of helped sober me up, and I was so scared of what had just happened that it never really occurred to me, and I got fired from my first job for drinking. Well, just keep that drinking going, and it got to the point where last year and a half, it was about a fifth and a half of whiskey a day. I had an opportunity at the age of 24. I knew when I was about 21 that I was an alcoholic. I knew that normal people did not have to drink every single day of their life in order to deal with life. And I admitted to myself, but I hadn't accepted it. And then at 24, I had to sort of go through the same gyrations again, and I was just back from college and staying with my parents, and I told them that I thought I was an alcoholic, and they said, oh, isn't that wonderful? We met this nice little man, you know, in Sears or something, and he's in AA. Maybe you should talk to him. And I'm going, oh, God, what the heck is this all about? So this man showed up that night named Freddie. Freddie took me to my first meeting. I was 24 years old. Freddie took me to Sister Ignatia Hall in St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, Ohio. And first thing Freddie said to me was, geez, you're so young. He said, I don't know where I could even take you. He said, I don't know anybody your age in AA. And I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be a lot of fun, you know. So he took me up to this alcoholic ward. And I'll never forget, we're going up seven flights of elevators, and anxiety attacks are just eating me alive because I'm in a confined, you know, I'm just losing my fears or just crippled me at this point in my life. And opening up the doors to the elevator, and there she was. This Sister Mary Resentment was staring me right in the face. And it's a picture of Sister Ignatia right there. You know, when you get up on the seventh floor, there she is. And all I remember was that nun in the fourth grade when I told her to eat a feces sandwich in front of the whole class. You want some excitement? Tell a nun to do that. Not with those exact words in front of everybody. After I said it to her, I even said to myself, Craig, that was stupid. She scarfed me up out of that chair, literally ripped my ear off, took me up to the Mother Superior's office. She was foaming at the mouth. She'd never heard anything like this in her whole life. She was losing it. This woman was losing it. Mother Superior didn't know what to do. He did what? She said. So she takes me into the other room, and she's trying to find a bar of soap to wash my mouth out. She couldn't find it. All she could find was powdered soap. So she got a handful of that and just, you know, just, that'll wake you up, I'll tell you what. I'm in the second grade because I act like a second grader, and I had to sit in the seats for 2 weeks with the second graders, even though I was in the fourth grade. Now, this is the agent of God, and the agent of God and I are not getting along real well. So it was pretty easy to see why I didn't need a power greater than myself, especially that one, because obviously, you know, I really had kind of broken down communications between his agent and myself, and therefore the Catholic religion just didn't have much room for me, and I really thought that I had been, you know, banished to the gates of hell. I mean, I was convinced from what they told me, and I got in a lot of trouble, too. I was a lot of energy, a lot of energy, and they wanted me to sit still, and I didn't want to sit still. And I was pretty bored, and so I just kept getting in a lot of trouble. Well, needless to say, you know, years of that, I started to begin to really think that there's something wrong with me, that I really am not fit, that I really am evil, I really am less than, and, well, all that goes away every time I get drunk. So I just kept doing that for years, 13 years. Towards the end of my drinking, that guy took me to that one meeting. met Sister Ignatia Hall first, went to this AA meeting. I left that meeting going, God, I'm glad I came to this. I'm thinking, this is so great. I know for sure now that I am going to control my drinking because I ain't going to be like them. I left that meeting convinced that I was going to control my drinking. Wow, that was a heck of an experience, and I'm glad I'm not like them. And I drank on the way home from that meeting. And that was another year and a half till March 6, 1978. A year and a half knowing that there was an alternative. A year and a half knowing that I was living in this delusion that I could drink normally. I believed something was absolutely wrong. I wasn't denying anything. I could deny that I played golf with you. As a matter of fact, I might deny that I played golf with you today. But I know that I was there, but I could deny it. But I'm not living under the delusion that I played with you. So at any rate, there I was, you know, between a rock and a hard spot. And after another year and a half of drinking, towards the end, it was a fifth of whiskey every single day. And I had the bottles here and I had the bottles there. And it was pathetic. Just pathetic. I was like this big and living out of boxes. And it was awful. It was just awful. And March 6, 1978, I fell down on my knees and I said, God, help me. And you know what? I meant it. I really meant it. I really meant it. And he has. He has definitely helped me. And I'd like to tell you that this is the part where everything just gets real well. However, wasn't quite that easy. After all, you were the derelicts of the world. After all, you were amoebas of society. And after all, you know, you were pathetic. So I got checked into this detox ward. I checked myself in. I knew the medical director. We used to play golf a lot. So as soon as he realized, one of my best friends, the medical director of this detox, realized I was there, he immediately transferred me somewhere else because he knows alcoholics. And I got transferred to a place called Molly Stark. And it's a sanitarium. And she knows where to look. She's cowering over. Oh, my God. Well, I drove up to Molly Stark. Clouds formed over that place. Actually, I was driven up. There was a huge black guy and a little teeny white. It looked like Laurel and Hardy in reverse in black and white form. And they put me in the back of a little teeny Volkswagen Bug, and they were in the front, and I'm losing my mind. I'm having anxiety attacks. I'm shaking. I'm going through DTs. This big black guy's turning around going to me, we're almost there. We're almost there. I'm going, where are you taking me? And this place was a sanitarium. And there's terminally ill cancer patients there. There's severely retarded adults that nobody can deal with. It is a dismal place. The first floor is for very rare terminally ill patients with diseases that they don't even know what they are. And the alcoholic ward is in the basement where the bars are on the windows. The color scheme is gray. I was in that room, and I wouldn't come out of the room for 3 days. I refused to associate with those derelicts of society. I was better than. I was different than. I was younger than. I was everything than. I was one large, metaphorical yabba. And they would say to me, you're going to have to come out of your room sometime. Oh, no, I'm not. Well, Donna told me, she was the counselor. She looked like a thermometer. She was about 6'7" and pregnant. Boy, was she tough, though. This woman could spit nails and they'll stick in the wall. She could do it in a pattern, too. She was beautiful. Really beautiful woman in there. But she said, you're going to have to come out eventually. She said, well, you know, tomorrow there'll be a man coming down from Alcoholics Anonymous. And when you leave here, you should probably go to AA because that's the best track record of anybody or any kind of thing we know today is that Alcoholics Anonymous will help to keep you sober. And this guy will come down and talk to you about the program, and he'll, you know, might even be a sponsor. Guy came in and started telling me his story. This guy was brutal. This guy it must have been your boyfriend, Mickey. He had the black leather matching jacket. He had the chain on the other side. He had 1,500 keys. He had tattoos from one side of him to the other. I think he had one on his tongue, you know? And he started describing a lifestyle that I didn't know anything about. Started talking about his last drunk, chasing his wife around the bedroom, trying to kill her with a butcher knife, and he was reacting. It's just like beads of sweat on us, and I was thinking, oh my God, could you just wait 1 second? I left the room. Go to Donna's office. Donna opens the door. I said, Donna, do I have to have this guy for a sponsor? She said, no, he's just here to talk. I go, thanks. And I go back to the room, and I sat and listened to the rest of his story, and he left. And next day, another person came down, and she said, well, tomorrow another guy's coming down. His name is Hollis. Now, this guy was great. He was sort of in his 60s, and he had gray hair, and it was combed back, and he had a tweed coat on with a leather patch on the elbows, and he had penny loafers, and he had a pipe that had this really aromatic tobacco, and he was very, you know, sort of very, very esteemed, and he was an attorney, a professor of law. And I'm thinking, I could use a good attorney. Plus, if I'm going to be in this amoeba society, a professor of law is a pretty distinguished, sponsor, I'm thinking, in all my haughtiness, pompousness, and self-centeredness, and conceit, and arrogance. And so he told me about, his drinking, and I thought, my God, this guy's perfect. And we had what I describe as the best relationship I could have had with a sponsor. I never called him, he never called me. And I did that for about the next year and a month or two. And that's really what I did. I did the best I could my first year of sobriety. I was not about to join this Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I admitted I was an alcoholic and that I had a problem with alcohol, but I was not going to join this fellowship because I was, yeah, but. So what did I do? I read part in Bill's story that talked about playing golf. It's in his girl over here going, well, he did. He played this part in his story. We talked about playing golf and cutting checks, impeccable code of tank, except that's when he was qualifying to get into Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. I didn't get that part. So I was doing what I thought was best. I played golf every day and cheated every opportunity I had. So I was at my best, out on the golf course, playing golf alone and cheating. Well, I remember calling my sponsor one time because I heard from my friends that he had a heart attack, that he was in the hospital. And I thought, my God, I better call him. And I showed up at the hospital. And it was right around Thanksgiving. And I went in there and I said, and there he was. He was in this hospital. He was hooked up to all these things. And I was just sort of petrified. I didn't know really what to say. And before I could even get two words out of my mouth, he said, Craig, boy, I'm glad you came. He said, I've been meaning to talk to you. He said, I've really been concerned about you. He said, you've been around this Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous for a while, and I think it's about time you start doing some steps, and I think it's about time you start to get active. I think it's about time you start to take seriously this recovery that we've got. Now, here's a man who's going in for an operation in the next 12 hours, and he's trying to help me. And I didn't even see that at that point. And I said, yeah, you're right. I said, as a matter of fact, tomorrow I have to moderate a panel called Gratitude Sunday in Akron. And is that what you mean? He says, that's exactly what I mean. That's the kind of thing you need to start doing. And then he said that his operation was at 3 o'clock the next day. And I thought, okay, that's great. Now, it's Sunday the next day, and it's about 3 o'clock. And I remember having to look at a watch because I was working on this panel and of old-timers. And right at 3 o'clock, I said a prayer for Hal. And then the proceedings of the day transpired, and I went home. And I got home, and I remember picking up the phone, and I called his wife, Flo, because I wanted to know what happened, And I said, Flo, this is Craig. How you doing? And she said, I've had better days. And I said, well, how's Hollis? And she said, he died today a little after 3 o'clock. And inside of 2 or 3 seconds, I had realized that one of the most outstanding members of Alcoholics Anonymous in Akron, Ohio, had died, who was my sponsor, claimed to be my sponsor, who I never used, who I never really went after what he had. He started one of the finest AA groups, AA meetings in all of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called Men's Tuesday Night Hilltop up in Akron, Ohio. One of the charter members of that group was extraordinarily active in AA. And I really had never developed any relationship with this really winner of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was gone. And something happened to me. I asked immediately, Flo, is there anything I can do? And she said, oh my God, thanks. She said, can you just stop by the store and get some milk and some bread? The kids got to go to school. I don't know what I'm doing tomorrow. I got to make arrangements. And I just took off and did whatever she needed done for the next 3 or 4 days. And I helped deal with the funeral home and helped, just whatever Flo needed, I did. I was at her every beck and her every call for the next 3 or 5 days. Whatever she needed done, I did it. And at this wake and at this funeral, there were hundreds of people from Alcoholics Anonymous, whom I'd never seen, who just had the most wonderful praise for this man that I didn't even really know. And he was gone. The dean of the University of Akron was there. The mayor of the city, as well as some of the finest neatest old timers and young people in Alcoholics Anonymous were there as well. It was amazing. And here was this person gone. But for the first time in my life, for 3 or 4 days, I didn't think about myself once. Whatever flow needed done, I did it. Now, I'm at a crossroads. All of a sudden, I'm realizing I'm like 12 or 13 months in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have a sponsor. I have a sponsor who died whom I never used. I'm going to one meeting a week and playing golf 6 days a week. Now, I'm out there on this golf course playing golf alone and cheating. I'm on this par 5 hole. I hit my tee shot, and I was waiting to hit my second shot to this green. Now, those of you who don't play golf, just bear with me. On the green are three people, and I'm thinking to myself, what's the par 5? I can't hit it that far. You know what I mean? It's too far away. As a matter of fact, I'll just lay up. I'll just take a club and hit short, and that way, by the time I get to that shot, they'll be off the green. And I projected in my mind an inventory. I made an inventory of this next golf shot. This is the first time I've ever done this now since I played golf. I sort of took the first easy-does-it approach to the golf swing in my whole life. Because before, I would just grab the club, squeeze as hard as I could, and try and cut. And the ball would go everywhere. It was like a perfect example of self-will run riot. But all of a sudden, I thought, well, I'll take my time, and I'll think about this golf shot. And I thought about this guy named Jack Nicklaus, who I read this book that said you should take an inventory of your swing before you do it, blah, 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 blah. And I did that. And I took a 5-wood, so that if I hit it, it would never even make the green. Well, I took this club back and went, phew. I looked at the ball, and I looked at the club, and the ball is flying fast. It's the best shot I've ever hit in my life. And all of a sudden, I realized the ball is going to hit the green where those three people are. And I scream, fire! And the ball flies right by this guy, and I almost hit him. Oh, my God. Now, if you're on a golf course, if you know anything about golf, you can get thrown off of a golf course for doing that. That's self-centered. It's impolite. It's rude. There's no etiquette involved. I'm your basic walking big book, right? Now, the guy that I almost hit on the green was this new guy I saw at my AA meeting about 2 weeks earlier. I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God, I almost killed this new guy. What does he think about me, you know? Here I am, this walking big book, you know, out killing people. So just before I could apologize to this old man, he said, that was a nice shot. And I immediately laughed. I said, well, yeah, it was. Thank you. It was a 5-wood, don't you know? You know, I didn't even bother to say, sorry, I almost killed you. And then he asked me, he said, well, do you want to play the rest of the round out with us? And I said, well, my God, that's great. I'm thinking to myself, this guy's really nice. Now, when I met this guy about 2 weeks earlier, it was at this one meeting I would go to every week. The Men's Hilltop that Hollis started, my sponsor. And I'll never forget seeing him standing on the other end of the room that night. Nobody had ever seen him before. His coat was draped over his left hand. He had that Pall Mall cigarette. I always remember those Pall Malls. Stuck to his lip, and he would talk, and it would move up and down. And the ash is this long, and it never comes off. You ever notice how that happens? I always wanted to walk around him like this, you know? There he was. I went right across the room. I put my hand out and I said, hey, my name is Craig. I'm an alcoholic. If you keep coming back to these meetings, these people can help you. And he took a step back and he kind of smiled at me and sort of coughed a little. And then he said, thanks. And then I went on my self-centered way. People go, hey, Craig, how you doing? I'm going, great, wonderful, fantastic. I mean, I hated you. I hated this. I was going to one meeting a week. I didn't want anything to do with you, you know. But I'm so, it's wonderful, fantastic. How are you? Good to see you, you miserable son of a man. Well, here's this new guy. Now, I almost killed him with a golf ball. He asked me to play with him, so we finished out the round. Now, my brain kicks into gear. He's new. Ask him to a meeting. I said, hey, would you like to go to a meeting? He looked at me and he said, sure, he says. So we get in the car. Now I'm driving this guy to this meeting, and I'm going, okay, let's see. Tell him about meetings, you know. Well, we've got open meetings, and we've got, you know, speaker meetings. We're going to a speaker meeting tonight. It's Copley Saturday night meeting, and we've got discussion meetings, and some are for men, and some are for women, and some are mixed. And, you know, I'm kind of enjoying this, you know, telling this guy. We went to the meeting. It was a good meeting, and afterwards, I'm thinking, my God, my brain kicks into gear again, and it says, fellowship. I've heard this word before. Do you want to go get something to eat? And he looks at me, and he goes, yeah, he says. So we're driving to the restaurant. Now I'm starting to really think about how you do this sponsorship stuff, you know. Well, you read the big book and you go to meetings and you don't drink, right? You know, read the big book, and all I had was bumper sticker sobriety. That's all I could remember were these bumper stickers. And, you know, and first things first, that's when I remembered, and easy does, oh yeah, we got an easy does it, you know, because we have to live one day at a time, there's another one. These things are coming out of my mouth, you know. Well, we're at the restaurant. We've ordered. We got food in front of us. I've taken a bite of my cheeseburger, whatever it is, and I'm just chomping along, you know. And this constitutes really the first time that this person's ever had a chance to even say anything to me, you know, in the first two times we've met and the last 6 hours we've been together. And he asked me about something that I was telling him in the big book. And he asked me about something that was on page 164 or I forget, 163 or something like that. And I'm thinking, God, I don't have any idea what he's talking about. So I'm not really that familiar with that part of the big book, I said, you know. And then he asked me something about the 12 and 12. I'm going, 12 and what? I thought it was like a pamphlet or something, you know what I mean? And I'm chewing my sandwich and I'm thinking, maybe he's not new. And I'm thinking, I said, hey, George, how long have you been in Alcoholics Anonymous? About that loud in a public restaurant. Now, I've almost killed him with a golf ball, and I've blown his anonymity in a public place. And he looked at me, and I'll never forget it. I don't know, he said, a reasonable length of time. What else do you know is in the big book? Don't. I'm going, oh, my God. And I said, and I am red, I am flushed, I am having an anxiety attack. I am, you know, 14 months dry in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am just full of it. And I looked up and I said, I'm sorry. I said, no, really, how long have you been in AA? I don't know. 16? No. 17 years, he said. Tell me what else you know is in the big book, Craig. Now, this new guy, right, that I'm having dinner with, that I'm going to sponsor, today he's my sponsor. That's my sponsor. Now, what is the point of all that? The point is this. 14 months dry in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did not know the difference between 17 days of sobriety and 17 years. It is cunning. It is powerful. It is baffling. And that is alcoholism. And I was one sick puppy, convinced in all my phoniness and my haughtiness and my arrogance and my pompousness that there was nothing to this and that I really didn't need you or the owner's manual and the instructions that are lying within. And I'll tell you what, that's one day I will never forget as long. I hope I never forget that day as long as I live. Now, needless to say, that is how I met my current sponsor. And this was different. My real sponsor that I never used had just died. I now found myself in a position without a sponsor, realizing because of Hollis's death that I absolutely let one of AA's best slip through my hands, and I lost the opportunity to learn a great deal from an outstanding member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so my mind was a little bit different at this point. And I asked him, I ran into him at another meeting, by coincidence again, about a week later at Thanksgiving night, at a meeting that was closed because it wasn't a holiday. And the two of us are outside in the parking lot, and there's this guy again, this new guy that I keep running into. And I asked him that night, I said, after talking to you the other night, I really felt bad, but you've been around like 17 years? I'm thinking, like, that's unbelievable. And I said, would you be my sponsor? And he looked at me and he said, why? It just really aggravated me when he said that. And I'm thinking in my haughtiness and pompousness, because I asked you. That's why. And he knew I was steaming. And he said, the reason I want to know why is, don't you even want to know, do I sponsor anybody else? Don't you even want to know, do I even have a home group? Don't you even want to know whether I've even worked these steps? Don't you even want to know whether or not I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I sort of, okay, you know, do you work the steps? Have you ever gone to and I said, will you be my sponsor? Son of a bitch. And he said, sure, he said. Do you have a dictionary, he said. I'm going, of course. I didn't. Well, who does? I want you to look up a few words, Craig. Oh, what are those? We and I. I'm thinking to myself, what idiot doesn't know the difference between we and I? I said, well, you know, who doesn't know the difference between that? You don't, he said. He said, you've got to Alcoholics Anonymous.
but we are going to keep you sober. He was right. I didn't know the difference between we and I, because it was I, me. What's the point? This is a fellowship with a suggested recovery. It is a group conscience that keeps these meetings and conferences together. It is the pluralness of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is the miracle I believe that I am able to stand here because of the grace of God that works through our many minds and hearts. But I didn't know the difference between we and I. And I got accustomed to looking words up because this man was insistent that I have an idea in my mind what words meant, so that as we communicated together, sponsor and sponsoree, that there weren't any sort of misunderstandings that could happen. Needless to say, in my first two encounters with this little thing from, you know, George is like 60-some years old. He's born and raised in New Orleans. He talks weird like a Cajun coon guy or whatever you call him. He's wrinkled up, you know, and he's beautiful. I love him, actually. He's the most wonderful human being in the whole world. But here's this man, you know, who's going to help me stay alive. And he just wanted to make sure I had no assumptions. So I started to look words up. And we worked steps. And we worked them in a very logical, progressive, deliberate, and conscious manner. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, in order, and worked through them. We did these things, etc., and so on. Came to the fourth step. You know, we did the first, second, third step, and third step prayer, and we got an understanding of that. And then it came time to do the inventory, and we're looking up words. And I won't bore you with a lot of this stuff, but we'll highlight the highs and the lows. When it came time for the fifth step, I remember there was a point where I had to talk about these things. And the first main area was resentment. You know, living in the past. My sponsor would say, "Did you look that word up, Craig?" "Yes, I looked the word up, George." And I thought that was enough. Then he'd say, "What does it mean, Craig?" Well, it sort of means to refill the hurt of the past. Somehow, someone did something to me or I did something to them, etc., and I'm living in the... "Why do you want to live in the past?" he'd say. And he showed me that resentments were living in the past. And he also showed me in that big book that they'll kill me. And he also showed me in that big book in about 7 different places that there are no more justified resentments. No more "yeah, buts." You're going to eliminate the word "blame" from your dictionary. From your vocabulary, throw it out. What did you do to provoke this situation? What did you think about? What could you have done to be more tolerant, patient, understanding, kind? Where could you change? This is your inventory, Craig, not his. Not your mom's, not God's, not the priest, not the nuns, not your brothers, not your girlfriends. None of that. This is your inventory. What can you do to clean? He showed me how to bite off and accept the truth about myself with regard to those resentments. And they're all the same in that sense. And you know what? When I bit the truth off about that and swallowed it, it didn't taste anything like that last drink, March 6, 1978, when I got up after another's night blackout and my feet are hanging over the edge of the bed and the fifth of Seagram 7 is sitting right there, and before my feet even touch the ground, I grab the bottle, I get a mouthful of straight alcohol, and I'm really got the heebie-jeebies, and I'm going like this, and it's still full of mouth, and I got to swallow this stuff in order to exist, and I take it in, and I hope to God it stays down, and it goes from here to here, and it's hot, and it's burning, and it's like... It's expanding and contracting, and I keep that stuff down, that first one in the morning. Ooh, you used to have those, didn't you? You used to have those. The truth about myself did not taste and was not as hard as that drink, keeping that down. So he showed me where those resentments were living in the past. Now, when I wasn't resenting the past, I was fearing the future. Future, future, future. Did you look the word up, Craig? Yeah, I looked up the word. What does it mean? Well, it kind of means to project, to be in the future, to think about things that haven't even happened yet. And basically... put yourself in a big quandary over nothing that hasn't even happened yet. "Why do you want to live in the future?" he'd say. It never occurred to me that when I wasn't resenting the past, I was living in the future, afraid of it. And so he showed me that the way you deal with fear is by faith. "You've been coming around to meetings," he said, "like 16 months now, right? You haven't had a drink, right? Did you get drunk?" "No." "Well, you now have the faith that you keep coming back to AA, you won't drink on a daily basis." And he showed me how my own actions were developing my own faith. My faith was first in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I didn't drink, I had the faith that I would probably get through that day without getting drunk. And so he showed me how to build faith. Now, when I wasn't resenting the past or fearing the future, I was experiencing guilt about sex in the present. And here I am, it's my fifth step, and I'm reading that part in here. Hey, this is my inventory. What's this doing here? No, this is... And I was reading that part about sex. I was reading that stuff about the things that I never wanted to tell anybody that I did in all these blackouts and all this different stuff that I had and all this drinking episodes and the things that I was ashamed of that I never talked to anybody about, that I only thought this is what you were supposed to do, etc. And I never forget, I went through the whole thing without even looking up. I think I didn't even stop for a breath, and I was doing this, and then a sweat's pouring down. I was really uncomfortable, and I looked up, and he was yawning. I really caught him yawning with that Pall Mall cigarette sticking on his lip. And he sort of knew I caught him, and he said, I sort of caught him, you know, and he just said, well, it was boring, he said. I mean, he was honest. It was boring. You know why? Because he told me about parts of his sex life, and my mouth flew open. I'm going, God, I didn't even know you could do things like that. Like, wow, that's wild, you know? Can't you get arrested for stuff like that, I'm thinking of? And he was right. Mine was boring. So what's the point of all this? This fifth step, basically, as I took and showed him all the where the patterns in my life, the character defects, where the inability to grow up and ask for help, and the false pride, and the arrogance, and the anger, and the immaturity, where all these things just kept boiling over, and I kept putting it away with alcohol. Well, I finally came to grips with a lot of that, read it to another human being, and for the first time in my life, there I stood in front of another man, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I literally, in a sense, was naked. I had told him everything about myself. My clothes were on, but I felt as if there was, I showed him everything in my whole soul. And he said three things, and I'll never forget it as long as I live. He said, I forgive you for everything you've done in your life. And he said, God forgives you for everything you've done in your life. Now I want you to spend the rest of your life forgiving yourself for what you did. And he planted the seed of self-respect right here. And I didn't know what he'd done at the time, but that's what he did. For the first time in my life, I had dug all the weeds out of the garden. I'd pruned all the bad branches. I'd turned the soil over. And for the first time, there I did as best I could, produced my fourth step, did my fifth step in Him in the presence of God. And He planted the seed of self-respect. And it took. And I'd like to tell you, this is the part where I just get really sober, but nope. Nope. Now that I can think in the present... Now that I can have a job, now that I can earn money, now that I have the ability to sort of be here now, now that I can actually go out with girls that can put a full sentence together, you know, now that I can actually have the opportunity to, you know, be in the social world, what do you mean go set up chairs at the meeting? What do you mean go make coffee? What do you mean get there and greet people as they come into the group? That's for the new guy. I'm going to go play golf and go out with girls. And I went on the happy dry drunk. I've already been on the self-pity dry drunk. That's when I went to Molly Stark and was in the room for 3 days. Don't want to be alcoholic. That's amoeba of the whole world. That's the worst thing. That's the self-pity dry drunk. Now I'm on the happy dry drunk. That works for everybody else. The new guys can do that. And I was off on my own having fun now. Going to meetings and just having my fun and, you know, just not, you know, just sort of having my fun. Well, I never forget, I called my sponsor one day because I got a letter from the 25th International IKIPA and they wanted me to come and speak. Oh, my God, I'm thinking they've come to their senses. I was so proud, I called up my sponsor. I didn't finish the letter that they sent. I called my sponsor up. I dialed him up and said, George, I said, I've got a letter here from IKIPA International, and, you know, they want me to come to the conference, etc. And he interrupted me. Craig, did you look up those words I gave you? And I'm thinking, I'd completely forgotten. I said, what words? Pompous, arrogant, conceited, self-centered. And I'm thinking, what is he and he just went off. He said, you were at the meeting last night, weren't you? And I said, yeah. He said, there was a new person in that room, wasn't there? Yeah. And he said, did you shake his hand? And I said, no. That was the last straw with him. He went up one side of me and down the other. He was reaming me. He said, if that's your idea of sobriety, that stinks, he says. He says, you're disgusting. It must be, you know, something that I'm not communicating to you, that you would be in a meeting with a new person and you wouldn't go shake his hand. But you got time to go this and go do that and get over here and wash your car and do all these things. And you're not even looking up those words and you're calling me about this. He says, you disgust me. He says, as a matter of fact, take the next week and get to some meetings and try and find another person to be your sponsor. And I'm thinking to myself, I called him to tell him how great I was. I must have dialed the wrong number. This has got to be the wrong number. And he's getting ready to fire me. And I begged and I said, George, you're absolutely right. And I got my dictionary down while I was even on the phone. Oh, yeah, pompous. It said, see, conceited, arrogant. Oh, these words are all related, George. Yeah, he said. You've gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and now it's time to give back to Alcoholics Anonymous. The last straw is you see a new person in a meeting and you don't go over and introduce yourself to them. You know, what's that all about? And I mean, he was right. He was absolutely right. And he went up one side of me and down the other. I said, please don't fire me. Please, I'm sorry. I'll change. I'm sorry. And he said, just get to some meetings and call me next week. You know, it said, I got to like 20 meetings that week. I couldn't believe it. But just before I hung up, he said, wait a minute. What's in that letter? Oh, yeah, right. The reason I'm reading. He says, what's in it? Oh, they want me to be on a panel. Oh, what's the topic? He said, I'm getting there. Will you just give me a minute? You know, and I'm, humility. George drops the phone. Now, in George's kitchen is a linoleum floor. He drops the phone on the floor, and it goes clink, you know, and all of a sudden I hear him hysterically in his Cajun coon-ass laughing, going, and he's losing it. And I can just visualize him losing it, you know what I mean? And I'm just, This is like going on endlessly. Now, he finally gets his composure. And what happens, because he smokes 3 packs a day, he goes into his coughing convulsion, and it's phlegm, and he's gagging, and he's coughing, and his cigarettes are everywhere, and he's just stuff's flying out. And I think he's going to die, you know, and he finally gets that together, and it's like 6 minutes have gone by now, you know. And he picks up the phone, and he says, what are you going to say? Now, what's the point? The point is this. I've now gone from the happy dry drunk to the spiritual dry drunk. I know a little bit about 12 steps. Been there, done that, got the t-shirt sort of attitude. You know, putting up the chairs is for the new guy. Making coffee is, what do you mean pick up a new guy and take him to a meeting? What if he throws up in my car? Really dangerous thinking. And now I was on the haughtiness. I was gossiping about other members in AA. I wouldn't go to a certain group because they didn't read How It Works. Or, you know, I was taking groups inventories. I mean, I was a really pitiful mess. I was that close to a drink. But I thought I was the greatest thing going. I was that close to a drink. Now, as a result of that last dry drunk, I like to tell you that that's the day I'll never forget as long as I live. I was sober about 4.5 years. And I immediately went to my Saturday night meeting, and there, as if it was a miracle, was this person I'd never seen before in my life. Back of the room. Hair was about this long. Head was like this. Hair was down to here. The belly was hanging out of the too small t-shirt. The rear end was out because the pants were too low. And I'm thinking to myself, there's a new guy. I now know the difference between 17 days and 17 years. And I shot across the room. I put my hand out. I said, hi, my name is Craig. I'm an alcoholic. Can I help you? And he looked up through that hair, dirty hair, I'll never forget, and he said, my name's Scott, and I'm an alcoholic. And we were just, I just fell in love with this guy. And I said, well, this is a big meeting, it's the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like you to have it. It's our owner's manual. It's got the instructions, etc. And I said, you'd like a ride home? I'd be more than happy to give you a ride. And he said, you know, that'd be great. I need a ride home. So I took him home. And I was driving to a part of Akron, Ohio I'd never been before. And I kept driving into places I'd never seen. And next thing I know, all the street lights are gone. The last 4 cars I've passed are completely stripped. No tires, no doors, nothing on them. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, there's like, I'm hearing gunshots, you know. I'm thinking, you know, is this the hood? Is this what they call the hood? You know, is this where I am? Yep, I was in the hood. And I was uncomfortable because I had never been in the hood. I was like a fish out of water, you know, just sort of flopping around on the boat. And he says, there's my house right over there. And I pulled up, and his stepfather is drunk on the couch on the front porch. His older sister's baby is 2 years old walking around in the street. You know, dirty. And then his mom comes out of the house. You know, the screen door's ripped open. The whole door's ripped open. Why even have the door on it? There's no screens on it. You know what I mean? And the place was the dirtiest place I'd ever seen in my life. He said, come on in. I'm going, oh, no, that's all right, Scott. I got to go, you know. I mean, I was uncomfortable. And he brought me in, introduced me to his mom. He said, come on in for a cup of coffee. He said, Scott, really, it's getting late. You know, and he drags me into the kitchen, and I never saw filth like that in my life. And Scott kind of realized I was getting a little uncomfortable with this. And he said, oh, yeah. He says, isn't this great? He said, we don't even use roach motels. When they run across the floor, they get stuck, and then all we got to do is step on them. And I didn't like this. And I got out of there as fast as I could. And I got in my car and I was driving and I literally hurried out of that environment. I didn't like. And something happened. I was driving away and I started to cry. I started to realize that I didn't live like that. I started to realize that I had an apartment that month rent was paid for. I didn't have any other money, but that month's rent was paid for. And that I was driving a car that I was making payments on, that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that all of a sudden that bedroom that I was so ashamed of because it didn't have great furniture in it was the most beautiful bedroom I ever went to in my whole life. And there was food in my refrigerator. And I had cleaned my kitchen that day. And I realized that I was so grateful for what I had for the first time in my life instead of what I didn't have. And I called Scotty the next day. I didn't wait for Scotty to call me. I called him up and said, Scott, would you like to spend the day with me? And he said, sure, I got nothing else to do. So I drove over and picked him up. And we're driving along, and I'm driving him out to this place he'd never been before. And how are we doing on time? Am I going too long here, or what's the deal? I keep forgetting about the time. Plenty of time. So Scott's kind of looking around. Now he's in my side of town now. And we get out, and he goes, hey, what is this place? I said, it's a golf course. He said, what are we doing here? I said, just get out. So he gets out. We get around the back of the car, and I open up my trunk. I pull out my golf clubs. He goes, hey, what are those? I go, they're clubs. You're going to carry them, you know, and I give them to him. And we walk up to the first tee. Now, I'm in an AA golf league, okay? A bunch of us, we developed a league in Akron, and it's Tuesday night, or Monday night, we're playing golf. And here I am walking up to the first tee with my AA golf league, and I got the new guy that I'm going to sponsor. He's my caddy. Now, this is not what my sponsor had an idea of service work, you know, is to get a new guy and make him your caddy, for Christ's sake, you know? Some are sicker than others, you know? So there's Scotty and I, you know, we're walking up to the first tee, and I was explaining to him what golf was, and I said, you give me this club here, and then Scotty loved this place. He's walking around, and there's birds, and there's no gunshots, and there's, you know, it's green, and, you know, people are nice to each other, and, you know, he kind of enjoyed it. And after we got done with the round, I paid him some money, and I said, you know that big book that we gave you last night from the group? I said, I'll put money in the basket tonight because you earned it. For carrying the clubs, here's money for doing that. And he liked that. He thought that was great. Well, Scotty asked me if I could take him to an appointment that he had the next day. And I said, well, I'd be glad to. Where is it? He said, downtown. So I drove downtown. It's the courthouse. And I said, well, what is this? Well, he says, I've been, you know, in and out of the detention home a few times. I said, really? What's that all about? He said, well, actually, they don't even want me. They kicked me out of the detention home. I said, what? He said, well, I've been in there about 16 or 17 times. I said, for what? Oh, petty larceny, you know, this, that, and the other thing, you know, setting fires and breaking and entering. And I'm going, jeez. I said, how old are you? He said, 14. And next thing I know, we're in a hearing. And it's like a probate hearing or something for minors or something. And we walk into this situation. There's a judge, you know, and there's people, and it's a little formal. And he walks in the door, and he sees the judge, and he goes, hi, Eddie. I go, Scott, that's your honor. It's not Eddie. You don't call him. He's on a first-name basis with the judge. And the judge immediately sees him and goes, what are you doing here? And he just kind of turned away, and I'm going, what is this all about? So anyway, it finally got around to Scotty. And the judge looks at me and goes, who are you? And I go, and Scotty goes, he's my sponsor. I was thinking, you haven't even asked me yet, you know? And so I said, oh, an Alcoholics Anonymous, are you going to those meetings like we told you? And Scott said, yeah, I'm going to those meetings. And I said, great. So, now what would you do with a guy like Scotty, who had been in and out of the detention home 16 sometimes for, you know, breaking and entering, petty thief, and all that sort of thing? Scotty grew up in a carnival environment. His dad was a barker at a carnival, you know. His real dad was shot in a drug deal when he was about 8, and had his head blown off. And so Scotty had no real direction, and all he knew how to do was talk. Scotty could con. It was amazing how he could talk for a little. Well, at any rate, we at the Young People's Conference, it was the third Ohio Young People's Conference that I was working on at that time. I was getting active in service work. Now, what would you do with a guy like Scotty? We put him in charge of the raffle. And Scotty was great. Scotty had this huge roll of tickets. And Scotty would sell tickets to anybody. Scotty started to threaten people if they didn't buy tickets. And he said, no, Scotty, we give them the choice. If they don't want them, we don't force them on them. You know what I mean? He says, I know I can sell them. I know. I said, da-da-da-da-da-da. So then he comes back to me about 3 or 4 days later. He's got a wad of cash. And I said, God, where'd you get all that? He says, well, I've been selling tickets. He says, I'll show you how I shortchange them. I said, what? I said, Scotty, we don't shortchange people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, we don't shortchange any other people either, for that matter. I said, no, this is an honest program, et cetera, et cetera. So Scotty raised like $2,000. Twice as much as had ever been raised before with the raffle tickets in the previous. At least that's what he reported he did. You know what I mean? He was wonderful, though. He was absolutely wonderful. And there were all of us participating in this Third Ohio Young People's Conference. And Scotty sold more raffle tickets than anybody. I'll never forget, one of the greatest thrills of my Alcoholics Anonymous recovery and the things that was to be the vehicle to help be an instrument like my sponsor has been to me. It's not my sponsor that's kept me sober. He's simply been the greatest messenger that I've found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And to be a messenger, to do this powerful message of Alcoholics Anonymous to come through, and it can happen in so many ways. It's happened to me in so many different ways to be a messenger of this message. Sometimes even when I'm having a bad day, I can be a good messenger as long as I talk about it at a meeting. And to be able to see this person get his one-year medallion, 15 years of age, and he got his one-year medallion at our Saturday Night Live Young People's Group, and it was one of the most wonderful experiences because I saw someone come from an environment that I would have never had been able to survive myself. I know I couldn't. I wouldn't have had the gumption and the guts to stick it out. And here he survived that situation and really made the utmost of it. And he inspired me so much. I don't know if what I did kept him sober, but he inspired me with his recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because he had so much less, but at the same time, he was such a powerful example to me. And I'm telling you, there's nothing better than that feeling that I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous, to be a vehicle through which this wonderful message, so that we can experience the joy of living in this fellowship. Now, since I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous, my life has changed immeasurably. I am glad that I didn't get what I wanted in life. I am so glad I got what I needed through the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It has exceeded my wildest dreams. If I could tell you just in this year what has happened to me in terms of my own life, what has happened to me in terms of my own business, what has happened to me in terms of just the experiences I've had in just the last month, it would take an hour just to tell you the ups and the downs of my last month. But it is the most wonderful life that I have because of this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I contribute to a home group, the Unity Group in Kansas City, Unity on the Plaza. If you are ever there, please come. I try to stay active. I sponsor a couple of men right now, three men in my town of Kansas City. Sat to a fifth step just last Sunday, one of the most wonderful experiences I can have. I communicate with my sponsor still, who lives in Akron, regularly, and talk to him this week, as a matter of fact. Now, what would you do with someone like me? You know, George, my sponsor, told me that in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was not just enough to stay sober, that I actually now have to repair the past with my parents and my family, and I have to get a job. I have to work. Just like Mickey was alluding to, we had to do something with your life. You can't expect others to always provide for you. You've got to do something. Now, what would I do with me? You know, what would you do with me? You know, and I asked my sponsor when I was playing golf with him, and at that point I'm counting all the strokes because my sponsor is brutally honest. I said, I wonder who designs these golf courses. Oh, that's an interesting question, he says. Why don't we write a letter? So I wrote a letter to a guy called a golf course architect. I didn't get any message or any return. I wrote to about 30 other ones, and nobody would even respond. And finally, about 6 months later, I got a man who wrote back to me and said, if you're interested in being a golf course architect, you know, here's what you need to do. And I said, well, can I come down and talk to you, et cetera? And he said, yeah, that'd be great. So I drove down to Columbus, Ohio, and met this man. And it was the greatest day of my life because I was thinking, oh, my God, you know, there's actually a thing, a profession called golf course architecture. And it was just amazing. I was like just a couple years sober when this had happened. And I drove down to the International House of Pancakes on High Street. Those of you from Columbus know where it is. And I never forget being there with this man. And then he told me, he says, okay, if you want to be a golf course architect, your odds, by the way, are about the same as being struck by lightning. That's how he opened the conversation. And folks, it went downhill from there. You got to go back to college and get this degree, and then you've got to have this experience, and you got to play golf, and you got to have construction experience and maintenance experience and landscape architecture degree, and this, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, every time he said something, I just kept sinking lower and lower and. So I was driving back to Akron, and I was in the most self-pity I'd been in a long time. I was completely deluded. I was thinking, there's no way in the whole world. That'd like take like 13 years. And he said, oh, by the way, there's no guarantees either. So I called my sponsor that night, and I said, he said, what do you say? And I said, George, just forget it. It's impossible. I said, this guy gave me this list of things. It's going to take like 13 years. He interrupted me. He always interrupts me at the worst time. What's the first thing on the list, Craig? Oh, go back to school. Isn't that interesting? Let's write a letter. So we write the letter, and then I went down and interviewed, and I got accepted to this school, Ohio State. So I went to school there and got another degree, and this time it was different. 5 years sober, sponsoring people. Have a little understanding. I'm active in my the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and in conferences and so on. Math class. I'd always failed math all my life. I had zero confidence in math, and I got to take math courses to get this degree. First day of math class, I sat in the front row. My sponsor showed me, didn't tell me how to stay sober. We'd sit in the front row at the discussion meetings. When I would go into a group, I would follow him, shake everybody's hand. You don't wait for them to go see you. You go shake their hand. Let it begin with me. I always used to say, let it begin with me. I'd like to let this begin with you, is what I used to think. But he showed me how these powerful principles can be applied in my everyday life. So in math class, I just automatically went and sat in the front row. And I always used to sit in the back row and be cool and dumb. That's what I always used to do, and talk and throw spitballs and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So we took this test the very first day. The teacher was trying to take an inventory of where everybody was. And I got the lowest grade in the class. They graded it, handed it back the next day. I got 3 right out of 21. 3 right. I missed 18. And when she said, does anybody have any questions, my hand shot out. I almost pulled it down like, what are you doing, you know? And I said, yeah, could you go over questions 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10? And I heard a guy in the back row, one of those cool guys, goes, is there something wrong with that guy? And I heard him. And you know what? I didn't care what he thought anymore. I wasn't there for his approval. I was there because I was there for my approval. And I said, yeah. She went over all the questions, and I still didn't understand them. And I went up afterwards with these fears coming in on me, thinking, oh, God, here we go again. I'm never going to do this. This is the first day of the first class, and I'm never going to. And she said, you know, we have people that can help you if you want extra help. You mean you got math sponsors? I'm thinking. And she looked at me kind of odd. She says, no, we have tutors. I said, well, that'll do. You know, I mean, same thing. What the heck? Look the word up. You know what I mean. So I went after class. I went down to the library, and I got a math sponsor. Now, it was cool. As we got to know each other, we talked. He says, what do you like? Well, I love golf, and I do this, and I like, you know, I like golf balls, and I know things, and I know golf clubs and golf courses. And as she realized how I thought, she was able to start to explain things to me because we started to communicate. And she was able to explain these abstract math terms. All of a sudden, I'm measuring things in golf balls and golf clubs, and things are clicking. And, of course, I'm going to class every day because I go to a meeting every day. And, you know, and I'm sitting in the front row, and I'm asking for help when I need it now. And I'm doing my homework, and all of a sudden, stuff is not quite as hard as it used to be because I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. Well, I applied the same principle, and to shorten this story, worked through a series of tests. It's finals. Final exam. First semester of college, and I was 175 questions on this math exam. I got 173 right. I got an A in the math class. Now, I applied the very same principles in that math class that I learned, honesty, open-mindedness, and the willingness to take action, and I applied it to chemistry. And I was having trouble with that. I got a chemistry sponsor. I had more sponsors than any person in that whole class. And you know what? They work. Do you know what I ended up doing the second year? I was a math sponsor. Because I learned it so well by working with someone, I was a chemistry sponsor. Next year, I was turning around, giving it away to someone else, and I was learning even more and more about it. And they were even paying me to do this. Now I'm actually getting paid. I kept going into the lunch line. I was 32 years old at the time, and I'm in college, and they're like 18 years old. And what do you know when you're 18? You know nothing when you're 18. You know what I mean? And I would always have a joke for the day to the women that were serving the food. And I knew they had a tough job, and nobody ever took them. They always took them for granted, and they were always, you know, no one was appreciative. And I would always have a joke that my jokes were awful. Matter of fact, I thought they thought I was on drugs or something, because nobody is this outward, you know. But I'm grateful for life and having the opportunity to be back in college. Well, this one woman who was the head cook had been watching me. And she, it was the end of the first year. She said, "Do you have a place to stay next year?" And I said, "No, I haven't yet, Mabel." She said, "Well, come on out to the farm, because you know we rent. I was renting a room from another school teacher, actually, and a little room in her out in this area." And I said, "I'd be glad to." I drove out to her house. I'll never forget it. It was a beautiful setting. It was a farm on 1,200 acres. They had the cows and the pigs and the sheep, and they had the bass ponds and the and there were orchards and crops, and it smelled beautiful. It was a 100-some-year-old farmhouse that sat up on top of the hill, and the driveway had a beautiful little curve to it. And I'm thinking, God, this is cool. And I got into the house, and she showed me the whole upstairs. That's what was for rent. And it was just brand new renovated. And as I was walking downstairs, I was thinking, there's no way I can afford this. I mean, I was hardly had enough money for school. Thinking, this got to be $300 or $400 a month. We got down to the bottom of the steps, and I said, "Mabel, that's really great, but I don't think I can afford this." And she looked at me and she said, "You know, I've watched you for the last year." And she says, "I like you." She says, "I've been talking it over with Russ, and we decided you can stay here for free. As a matter of fact, I'll feed you 3 meals a day. But Russ has got a bad back." That was her husband. And he says, "You know, if it snows, would you shovel my walk?" And this is not supposed to happen to me, to anybody. And I have free room and board. I'm getting paid to tutor other people in school. And because of my academic excellence, I received 2 academic scholarships for that year. I was making money going to school. Making money going to school. And I got done with that other thing on the checklist, and then my sponsor says, "What's the next thing on the list, Craig?" And it was, "Well, you got to go to work for a contractor." And I went to work at Valhalla and helped. And I went to work for a company that builds golf courses, and they're hosting the PGA Championship in Louisville on the golf course that I went and learned about that. And then when I did that, I ended up working for another guy. And then I had another degree, and then I got registered, blah, 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 blah. 2 years ago, at Turnberry, the ELSA course in Scotland, where the home of golf is, I was inducted in as a full member of the American Society of Golf Course Architects, 14 years later from that date, where I came home and asked my sponsor, "Do you think I could ever do this thing?" And I have accomplished, through the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, a method that sells me on page 63, because I now have a new creator. I have a new father. I have a new power. I have a new source that loves me and wants me to enjoy life, insists that I enjoy life, and that I enjoy the pleasures of life. And it shows me in that big book that I can face life successfully. I'm not taking the credit for it. It's not my success, but it tells me that I can face life successfully. What does that mean? It means today I can be honest, open-mindedness, and I can be willing to ask for help when I need it. Now, the greatest tribute that had happened to me, I was always so ashamed of how I did not measure up in my parents' eyes, because I'd basically become a drunk. And no mother or father, Mickey was talking about, wants to see their sibling, an alcoholic, in the depression of alcoholism. And my parents really had thought it was their fault, because they weren't a good enough parent, that that's the reason I had become an alcoholic. And that really wasn't the case. I was just out of control. Just absolutely out of control. And here I am in this wonderful fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was asked to speak at this graduation class. When I had graduated from college, I was voted as president of the Student Senate. And they said the Senate has to address the graduating commencement. And the dean of the school at Ohio State came up and talked at the very beginning of commencement, and he was boring. 5 minutes. And the dean of the lieutenant governor for the state of Ohio came up and talked. Boring. And I gave my 5-minute talk on what I called the indispensables to learning: honesty, open-mindedness, and the willingness to take action. And how I applied that to my 2 years at Ohio State University to a standing ovation by these people. And all I did was steal what was written on page 571 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the indispensables to the spiritual experience. And the best I had to offer was what you have offered me. That's the best that I had to offer. And my father and my mother were in the front row. That was the amend. My mom was so ashamed when I went in to make my message. She said, "It's because of me that I was there." "No, Mom, being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know you don't understand this, but maybe you will someday, is the single greatest thing that has happened to me in my life. And thank you for being the mother that you were, etc., etc., and so on. Now, to finish this up, my sponsor, whom I love and respect and honor and will always, always cherish, I said to him, you know, George, when you knew that I was mistaking you as a new person, why didn't you stop me? Oh, you were beautiful, he said. You were beautiful. You had all that enthusiasm. Enthusiasm, I had never heard those words associated with me. I'd heard, he's hyper, he's tense, he can't focus, he's bored, he needs a psychiatrist, he needs this, he needs that, he doesn't have what it takes, he should become a beautician, he should do this, he should do that, you know, there's something wrong with him, he's, you know, I mean, he's just whatever, he's, nobody ever said he's enthusiastic. He's hyper, he's tense. And do you know what I did when I was back at college and getting that, I was becoming so enamored in the process of looking up words. I was in the College of Worcester Library, and I was at the Cambridge Unabridged Dictionaries. One volume for every letter. Each, like the letter A, had like 1,800 pages. This is like the ultimate dictionary, right? And so that night I looked up the word enthusiasm, because, you know, he said that's what I had. And I looked it up, and it comes from a Greek word, entheos. And it's Greek, and it means inspired by God. That's what enthusiasm means, inspired by God. Now, when I was in New York at that Young People's Conference, the 25th International, I ended up going there and was on that panel, and oh, did I have a great story about humility. Remind me to tell you about it sometime. We went to Intergroup office, we went to World Service headquarters and the Grapevine, you know, all of us were all in there. It was really a neat experience. And I was in touring the halls of AA where Intergroup is, and I saw on the wall the letter written by Dr. Young to Bill Wilson. When Bill was writing the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, Dr. Young, you talked to a member of ours. You said he had to have a spiritual experience. What is it? And this was his response to Bill Wilson. Dear Mr. Wilson, thank you for, you know, blah, blah, blah. I can't really tell you in psychoanalytic terms what a spiritual experience is. Now, that's being very humble. Here's one of the greatest psychiatrists in the world saying, I don't really know. I can't even tell you in theological terms what it really means, because I'm not a theologian. I can't really tell you in metaphysical terms. He said, but I've traced its word, to the word alcohol to its origin. It comes from a Latin word, means spiritus. Spiritus. And that night that I was in the College of Worcester, in that fit of open-mindedness, that happens about once every 5 years for me, after I looked up the word enthusiasm and found out it came from a Greek word meaning inspired by God, I looked up the word alcohol. Sure enough, through the evolution of the word of alcohol comes spirits. Because it was the spirits that used to be in wine, that used to make the knights of the round table get all drunk and forget where they parked their horse and their lance and all that sort of stuff. You know, where's my lance? Where's my horse? What's that taste in my mouth? You know what I mean? And they didn't know what to call it in medieval days, so they called it spirits, because it came from the Latin word spirits. And I looked up that word, and I traced it all the way down to its end, and that word means the breath of life. That's what alcohol means. Now, we call it alcohol because it's an organic molecule. Scientists have broken that spirits down in the wine, and it's an alcoholic molecule, but we are breath of life anonymous. So my new definition of what it means to be an alcoholic is not that amoeba of society that I was so ashamed of in Molly Stark. It is the breath of life inspired by God. Thank you for having me.